All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I am a former helicopter pilot during the Vietnam conflict, as they call it. I was a CW-2 as a warrant officer, closest thing to a civilian that the Army had. I loved my what I was doing over there, and we're going to be talking a little bit about that in just a second. I've got a great guest for us today on Veterans Radio, and I can't wait to talk with him. His name is J. Cale Weston, and he's written a book entitled The Mirror Test, and it's about America at war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think you got to stay tuned for this one. I think it's really, really an important story, and it's something I think we're going to learn a lot about as we get to listen to Cale talk about his experiences. For over 7 years, he was in Iraq and Afghanistan as a government worker, so I think that's kind of cool. All right, folks, all you Vietnam veterans out there, guess what? We now have our own day. Ta-da! Finally. President Trump signed a law declaring National Vietnam War Veterans Day. It's going to be on March 29th every year in perpetuity, as they say, from here on out. And it's one of those days where people are authorized to fly their flags. But here at Veterans Radio, we believe that everybody should fly their flag every day. It's a fly your flag day. Every day is a fly your flag day. But the bill was sponsored by Senator Pat Toomey, a Republican of Pennsylvania, and Joe Donnelly, a Democrat of Indiana, so bipartisans can get something done. How about that? And in their statement, they say 44 years have passed since the last U.S. troops withdrew from Vietnam. Due to the unpopularity of the war, veterans returning home were often met with disdain and did not necessarily receive support or gratitude for their service. And this is one of the things that they felt that they could do. Honor the Vietnam veteran, and as we honored all warriors, we try to. Out of the 2.7 million U.S. service members who served in Vietnam, more than 58,000 were killed, and more than 304,000 were wounded. I was just up at the Ann Arbor VA hospital the other day, and that place is getting crowded with Vietnam veterans, folks, so we've got to make sure that we take care of these. I should point out that a proclamation by President Obama declared March 29, 2012 as Vietnam Veterans Day, but that was only a one-time deal. And so now President Trump has signed the law declaring National Vietnam War Veterans Day, so every March 29th, go up to your local Vietnam veteran and say welcome home, because that's the message that we love more than anything else. The other thing, speaking of Vietnam veterans, is I'm not that familiar with Facebook and how it works and so on and so forth, but I got a great story from one of our favorite people here on Veterans Radio, and his name is Joe Galloway. And Joe Galloway is an author. He was in Vietnam. He was a journalist. He was at the Battle of the Idrang Valley. He was the author of one of the books, We Were Soldiers Once and Young. He is the only journalist to receive a Bronze Star for Valor. Because of what he did during that day. And he's written many books, and, of course, he has many commentaries and so forth. But he had an adventure the other day that I thought was kind of reminiscent of some that maybe some of you out there have had. He was driving down the road in Virginia, and he said he was behind this truck, and the truck was moseying, and Joe didn't want to mosey anymore. So he pulled out and passed him in a no-passing zone. Within seconds, he said, the blue lights come on, the red lights come on directly behind him, and they pull him off to the side of the road. And he said a very polite police officer came up, wrote him a ticket for passing in a no-passing zone, got back in his car, and Joe said, I drove away. And he said, this cop car followed me. It was following me. It's 10 miles, 11 miles, 12 miles. He's still back there. I'm going, what have I done? He's going to get me again. Sure enough, just a little bit down the road, the blue lights, the red lights come on, and he pulled me over again. And I'm going, what did I do now? I've got another ticket coming? What? He says, the cop walks up to the window. I roll down the window, and I said, what? And he says, Mr. Galloway, I had no idea who you were. And he took the ticket and crumbled it all up and threw it over his shoulder. And he said, my dispatcher, when I told him who I had pulled over, went nutto and said, do you know who you just pulled over? And the policeman that had written the ticket initially said, I just want to thank you as a veteran myself for all you do to support veterans' causes. And he says, you know, have a safe trip home. And Joe says, so we got back on the road and continued on south toward home. And I don't know about you out there, but I have had a similar experience where I was pulled over one time by a policeman. And I have a one of those license surrounds, and it says United States Army Aviation School on it. And as he walked up to the car, I saw him look over and look at the license plate. And he came up and he says, sir, he says, are you a veteran? I said, yes, I am. And he says, sir, I would suggest that you slow down. And he walked back to the car, and that was it. So, you know, if you're nice to him and you've got a veteran sticker on your car, you know, it's like those the Police Benevolent Association or whatever it is. Maybe if you don't do something too bad, you might be able to get away with it and get that warning instead of getting the ticket. So anyway, so Joe Galloway, thanks for sharing that story. I thought it was kind of fun that you did that. We're going to take a break real quick, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Cale Weston, who is the author of the book, The Mirror Test. And let me give you a little promo about him before we could do that. He represented the United States for over a decade as a State Department official and political advisor. Prior to his wartime service, 7 consecutive years in Iraq and Afghanistan, alongside U.S. Marines and soldiers in Fallujah, Khost, Sadr City, and Helmand. He led American efforts in the UN Security Council to freeze and block al-Qaeda-linked assets. Washington acknowledged his multi-year service in Fallujah with the Marines by awarding him one of his highest honors, the Secretary of State's Medal for Heroism. So this is our guest right here on Veterans Radio. So let me remind you, if you want to talk to Cale, you can give us a call here at WAAM. The number is 734-822-1600 or toll-free 844-838-1600. That's 844-838-1600. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and listen to our podcast on our website, veteransradio.net. And we're going to, as I mentioned, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back with our guest, Jake Cale Weston, the author of The Mirror Test. You're listening to Veterans Radio. And we are back on Veterans Radio, and bringing my guest on the line right now is J. Cale Weston, and his book is The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan. Cale, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale, and I appreciate the opportunity and the invitation.
Thank you very much. I couldn't find a theme song for the State Department, so I figured that would be as close as I could get with the Marines, since you spend so much time with them anyway.
Yeah, we may not have a State Department for too much longer.
We can talk about that as we go along. the title of your book is The Mirror Test, and I wanted our audience to understand what the mirror test is. So could you give us a little definition of what the mirror test definition is?
Sure. It's a medical term that doctors use when they've got a patient who particularly is badly disfigured in the face, and they let those patients determine when they're ready to look over their shoulder or look square on in the mirror and kind of come to terms with how the injuries have disfigured them. And in the case of my book, I focus on a Marine named Aaron Mankin, who was badly facially disfigured in a roadside bomb, and he writes very eloquently about when he was ready to have his own mirror test. And I apply that throughout the book to the larger questions I think that we as a nation should consider when it comes to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So tell me, how did you get involved with the State Department? What is your background?
You know, I guess there's kind of two levels. One, I am the son and grandson of soldiers, also the nephew of soldiers, so one might think that the military was a more likely course for me. But then by the time I was in high school, I found myself hanging out with a lot of foreign exchange students, and I was putting a lot of maps on my wall as a kid next to, you know, those of the ski resorts and the national parks. And I think I was always kind of focused on what was going on far, far away from my hometown, and then that led to studying a lot of history and international relations as a graduate student, and started a PhD and realized I was more interested in what the policy challenges were the day than maybe the theories. And so I opted to make it official and join the State Department.
Okay. And so where did you start out?
I started out in the Netherlands for a bit, and then a big chunk of my time was in New York City right after and even right before 9/11. So that really shifted the trajectory of my career, which I thought would be a lot of sort of the traditional diplomacy, UN Security Council issues, which is suit and tie every day, and a lot of Chapter 7 negotiations with various other delegations. And I think for many diplomats, 9/11 really shifted a lot of our careers, and many of them are still in some pretty tough places based on what happened 15 years ago.
It's hard to believe that it's been 15 years. That's for darn sure.
Yeah.
All right, so you ended up going to Iraq in 2003. Did you go in right at the beginning of the invasion?
Just after. I was in New York at our mission there when Secretary Colin Powell made the case for the invasion, and then there was about 50 State Department personnel who joined that first wave in. I got there. I went to a mini civilian boot camp at Fort Bliss, Texas, which ironically was where my uncle went before he shipped off to Vietnam as a Green Beret, and I arrived in Baghdad in early August of 2003.
And what were your responsibilities there?
I spent most of my time that first year on a responsibility that I thought I wasn't going to like nor be very good at, and that was dealing with the truckers, the Teamsters of Iraq. At the time, the insurgency was starting to pick up, and our government and our policy under the Coalition Provisional Authority was focused on making sure that the food staples made their journeys across the highways and byways of Iraq. So I got to know quite well a number of the main truckers in Baghdad.
So you ended up working with the truckers like a union, right?
Correct.
The logistics of the whole thing.
Yeah, it was not the fancy, you know, stuff I thought I might be doing, and ended up really, really loving the job. And I'm grateful that that became my focus, because I really got to understand, I think, the street level experience of Iraq through the eyes of everyday Iraqis, as opposed to the palace intrigue and the palace opulence and the fancy food that we had shipped in for us. So I had my eyes open pretty quickly through the truckers.
One of the complaints at the time, and probably is still going on, is that when we went into Iraq, we pretty much eliminated everything, you know, and started to try and reinvent the country. And I think that, you know, one of the issues that I'm sure that you ran up against, as you mentioned, the idea of actually trying to provide food and clothing and everything for the Iraqi citizens who were kind of left out of the decision-making process.
Yeah, they were even in that early phase of 2003 not focused on the next election that we were bringing to them courtesy of our military. They were focused on, first and foremost, stability and security, and then what we all focus on, which is making sure that you can get on with your life and have enough food to feed your family. And then, you know, we overlaid that with a lot of democratic talk, and I think some good historians have looked back and come to the conclusion I had pretty early, which is first things first. They may want to import some things, but we were trying to export democracy very quickly and according to our timeline.
So after you were working, how long did you work with the truckers? You say over a year?
Yeah, from summer of 03 to summer of 04, and then I was asked to go out to Fallujah.
Oh, aren't you lucky? We've had many, many guests here on Veterans Radio who are involved in the battles of Fallujah more than once, it seemed. So what was your job out with the Marines?
I was one of about five State Department officers, Ambassador Negropani, who had been my boss and a very good boss, understanding boss in New York, asked me to be, you know, the main political guy working with the Marine Command. And at that time in Western Iraq, we had about 38,000 troops under General Conway's command as the 1MEF commanding general. My job was to try and make sure that military tactics followed the political plan that we were implementing, and a lot of that had to do with first clearing the city of Fallujah of terrorists and a lot of homeboys trying to find Zarqawi, who was the main al-Qaeda leader at the time, so that Sunnis in the West could vote. Because, of course, at that time, the Bush administration, President George W. Bush, really wanted to try and show that these elections were going to stick and that all parts of Iraq were going to vote. So that became my prime directive, which was to get Sunnis to vote.
And how did you go about doing that?
It was tough.
I can imagine.
You know, the Sunni areas in the West were the most anti-American in the whole country, for the reason, obviously, that we had kicked out them as a minority from power. So I knew that they were not going to be happy partners. But starting from the bottom up, I focused a lot on who were the key leaders inherent in the area, and those would be the religious leaders, the imams. Fallujah is the city of mosques, so I knew that was a key population I needed to focus on, the tribal leaders, and then we were starting to set up local city councils. So altogether, I was spending quite a bit of time with a lot of very able Marines and some soldiers, a lot of civil affairs officers, trying to show that once the big battle was over, the rebuilding could happen with a lot of money, but also we needed to begin to trust each other.
Were you one of the ones that was going around handing out the money for these various projects?
I was. It was not State Department money. It was CERT money, which was a pot of money that the military initially took from frozen assets of Saddam Hussein, which was authorized by the UN Security mm-hmm. Council, and then that became programmed money through our own Congress. But yes, you know, the famous line that money is a weapon system, that's true. But money is also a trap in a war zone, and I saw both sides of that. So the Marine sergeants and corporals would come with their backpacks full of a lot of U.S. cash, and I would help make sure that if we had injured a child in an escalation of force incident, or we had damaged a vehicle or a part of a house, that we were at least trying to pay up, although, of course, money never solves death, but it at least can help alleviate some of the tension.
Wow. So as that election was coming forward, what year was that in? 2004?
The big battle, in order to set the election, to set the stage for the election, was toward the end of 2004, starting in November, and it carried through the winter. But the three big intense democratic experiences that we were pushing on the Iraqis at the time were in 2005. There were subsequent elections that happened after, but the three big ones were all in 2005. So there was a parliamentary election, there was a constitutional referendum, and then there was a third one at the end of the year. So we were demanding a lot of a people, in terms of their willingness to go vote, when, again, most of the Iraqis and the Fallujans were telling me that they were more concerned about just baseline security.
Mm-hmm. We've had an author on. His name is Bing West. You may be familiar with him.
Bing is a grunt at heart, and he he was last in Helmand with us, charging through the desert with corporals. And I have a lot of respect for Bing.
Oh,
he charges to the front.
Well, yeah, he does, and he's always got an opinion, which is what I, which is refreshing.
Or a dozen, and he advocates them very effectively.
Yeah. Well, the reason I brought him up was his book is called The Strongest Tribe.
Right.
And the idea of all that these people wanted was just safety. And so their allegiances would, be flowing, I guess you could say, back and forth, depending on who could help them out the most.
Yeah, Bing and I have talked a lot about this in both Anbar and Helmand, and I think we come down on the same side of this, which is it's one thing to sort of try and idealize a democratic Iraq or a democratic Afghanistan. It's another thing when you've got roadside bombs proliferating, you've got HIMARS being used by the Marine Corps, you've got assassinations of your local partners, which is really a level that I try and get to in my book, because
yes.
The heroes of my book, first and foremost, I want to advance are the Iraqis and the Afghans who stood with us and paid a huge price for that. So The Strongest Tribe is the Marine Corps, is the U.S. military, mm-hmm. but the most long-lasting tribe will never be an American tribe. And I think those were the issues we were trying to figure out as we stayed year after year.
You mentioned in the book, we're talking with Cale Weston, the author of The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan. And this story of Fallujah and being in Iraq and so forth, there's a scene in the book about the potato factory, which was very distressing to me and probably to a lot of people, and I'm sure it was to you. Could you tell our audience what that was about?
I will, and I hope that readers don't stop reading the book.
No, don't. This is very, this is precepts a lot of things.
It was hard for me to write. My editor, to his credit, and my team in New York, incredible team, they pushed me on that chapter. And you know, when authors talk about writing a book, that probably is a chapter I would have left out if not for Knopf and Random House saying, this is a side of war that people really need to see and read and smell. And so that was a war that the Marines were forced to set up very quickly in that early phase of Al-Fajr, the big Fallujah battle that commenced right around the Marine Corps birthday, actually, November 7th, a few days before. What happened is the political pressure went through the roof at the White House level. Then National Security Advisor Condi Rice was on the phone with Marine leaders, and my boss, the ambassador, was engaging me as well as getting phone calls from the Iraqi leaders, because when the Marines were clearing the city in the largest operation since Vietnam, very quickly we had an issue of how to take care of the bodies that were, you know, we wanted to help bury in line with Islamic custom. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is a very quick timeline. And so the potato factory was literally a reefer to store potatoes to keep them cool before they were turned into potato chips, of all things. And then that became the location where a bunch of very brave and, yes, heroic Marines were tasked day in and day out to pick up bodies and make sure that we, at least to the extent we could, figure out what kind of, you know, were they Syrian fighters or were they a grandfather who was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so the goal of that chapter is to just show the ugliest face of war, but to also show our military trying to do its best in basically impossible situations. And then I end the chapter by pointing out a character who was very crucial in making a bad situation a little bit better, and that's the Grand Mufti, the main religious leader in the city. And he proved to be incredibly important when Fallujans came back wanting to try and find the bodies of their dead brother, uncle, mother. And so he became the voice saying, let's not literally dig up the places where the Marines had to bury these bodies. And that allowed us to move to a different chapter.
Right. And then we get to the point of, and was this the... I forget his name now. I can't find it.
Sheikh Hamza?
Yes. Is that him?
As far as there's a chapter that I focus on him and Sarah El-Jamali, a female who was detained twice in about 2 or 3 weeks by a Delta Force team. And I wanted to put that in to show that while our Delta and Special Operations Forces have a hugely important role, that sometimes well-meaning objectives can really undercut the strategic partnering that we had on. And the net effect there is that when we took a female twice in a few weeks, Sheikh Hamza was put even under more pressure by Zarqawi and Al-Qaeda directly. And I'll never forget, he said, you know, you Americans are putting me personally at risk by taking this female. The argument on the special operations side was that she may have intel and ties to Zarqawi, so I understood how important that would be if true. But what I kept on not getting out of the embassy and out of JSOC and literally McChrystal and Tampa eventually was a solid answer. So all I know is we lost the most important Iraqi in one of the most important cities in Iraq because we took a female twice in 3 weeks. And so I hope that chapter and those lessons are really internalized, not to point fingers, but to say we all did the best we could, but let's not forget stories like those. And all of us who are in these wars have them.
Right. And you were talking about Sheikh Hamza as being so integral in working in the Fallujah area, not only with, as you mentioned, with the story of the woman, but with the burials and everything else. And unfortunately, he was eventually assassinated.
Yeah, he was. And he was, you know, when the ambassador asked me who killed Sheikh Hamza, I said we did. I mean, we didn't. Mm-hmm. It was not an American bullet, but because of, we're our own worst enemy often because we're so big and we have so much massive military might that we're not always, I think, communicating quickly nor honestly. And I think that was a case study in Iraq, and then I have another one in Afghanistan. But when we lost the Pope in Rome, and Hamza was like the Pope in Rome, mm-hmm. but for, you know, the city of mosques, the main religious leader in Fallujah, I'm blunt about it. More Americans died and lost their limbs, and so did more civilians. So it's not to say, you know, we could have had a crystal ball to walk us out of the city, you know, in a safe mm-hmm. and orderly way. But we sure as hell ought to remember these lessons and also remember the people, because when I went back to Fallujah a few years later, I asked one of my closest Fallujah contacts, you know, who's the new Grand Mufti? And they said, you know, there will never be another Sheikh Hamza.
Right. Well, we're coming up on a break right now, Cale. And so when we come back, I want to talk about that helicopter mission that really changed your life so dramatically. We are talking with Cale Weston here on Veterans Radio. His book is The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you can give us a call if you'd like to ask him a question. You're not going to have this opportunity too often. The number here is 734-822-1600. We're on WHAM Talk Radio 1600. You're listening to Veterans Radio, and we'll be back after the news. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and if you're just joining us, our guest today is J. Cale Weston, and his book is The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I just want to read a little paragraph that I found on Newsweek.com about Cale, and it says that Weston stands alone in the annals of modern American diplomacy. He spent more time in Iraq and Afghanistan 7 consecutive years than any other State Department officer. What he did there couldn't have been more different from traditional cocktail party diplomacy. He was a political advisor to combat units on the battlefield, where he forged uncommonly honest and effective relationships with top commanders, giving him unrivaled influence in shaping war policy on 2 fronts. His bravery and persistence awed his fellow diplomats and prompted several generals who reserve praise for only the most deserving to consider him an American hero. I think that's a pretty good description of our guest today. So, Cale, just before we went to the break, I'm assuming that one of the worst days of your life was when 30 Marines and a Navy corpsman died in a helicopter crash in Anbar province in Iraq, and you hold yourself responsible. Could you tell us how that occurred?
Yeah, it was a part of the book that I wanted in because it shows the human costs of policy, and having been at, you know, the UN Security Council level and the higher level State Department kind of debating rooms, this is an example of where policy is decided and implemented on the ground. It goes back to your kind of question about the elections. We had mm-hmm. to come up with a plan in early 2005 how to support the Iraqi political process, and of course we had 38,000 Marines and soldiers and U.S. service members in a very large swath of the country in the West. And the debate inside the Marine High Command and with me as the embassy guy was, do we go local and narrow in that mission in terms of the helicopters, the Humvees, the 7-ton trucks, everything that gets mobilized to move ballots and to move Iraqi election personnel? Or do we say to the Sunnis out west, whether you're from a small town or a big city like Fallujah or Ramadi, you will have, and your people will have, if you're a leader, the opportunity to vote. I knew what the ambassador wanted me to do. I knew what the Bush administration, for that matter, wanted me to do, which was to advocate that we need to give as many Sunnis the chance to vote. The dilemma was that they were telling me on a regular basis, the leadership in Anbar, and particularly Fallujah, that they were going to boycott the election because they were pissed. They didn't want to be doing democracy according to our watch. Mm-hmm. I went into a room with the MEF, the Marine Expeditionary Force leadership, and a team from Ramadi had been sent to Fallujah to advance their argument, which is we should just focus on Fallujah and Ramadi. I ended up saying, well, if we do, we're going to gerrymander, and if we do, we're going to have senior Sunni politicians get on the phone with the ambassador the next day and say, my people didn't have a chance to vote. What came out of that was a decision, in effect, by me, because General Halleck at the time said, it's political, it's your call, was to send Marines far and wide. And the tragedy was one of our CH-53s carrying volunteers for this mission to support the elections crashed, and it's the largest casualty incident from both wars to this day. And I, of course, wish I could go back and have said something different in that room, but I wrote about it not to sort of put on paper my own personal drama, but to show accountability and consequence. And I don't think there's been enough of that, especially in the Iraq war, but also in Afghanistan. And maybe in my own way, I can say, listen, this is what happens when you go to war. People are going to die, and we should think hard about what the situations were that led us to the point where we are in a war. And maybe the war was an unnecessary war, and I believe the Iraq war was in that category.
I have a tendency to agree with you on that. How long were you in Iraq?
I was in Iraq for almost 4 years. I ended up being asked back at the tail end of the Bush administration. My great mentor and boss, Ambassador Robert Ford, had been asked by Condoleezza Rice, Secretary Rice, to go back to Baghdad while I was in Afghanistan. And so he asked me to return to Iraq. I was enjoying my job in the eastern mountainous region of Afghanistan, which reminded me a lot of Utah and Colorado and just landscape I love. But I ended up going back. But most of my time in Iraq was spent in Anbar. So that incident, you know, in the book, and I'm getting reactions from readers across the country, and it's interesting. The policy people, you know, the literati people in New York in that eastern corridor probably think I should have just kept it on the wars, but the readers in the rest of America say thank you for bringing us into these hometowns where some of these service members come from, and not only where they come from, but where they're buried. You know, a lot of focus every May on Memorial Day is on Arlington, and that's an incredibly powerful place. But most of our veterans and families, you know, don't live in the D.C. metro area. And when they're buried, they're more often buried in their hometowns. And so most of the 31 angels, as I call them, the KIA on that helicopter, are not buried at Arlington. And in the course of the book, I go to a few and say, you know, let's get to know these parts of America as well.
I think it's always important, and you mentioned this in the book, where we were talking with Cale Weston, the author of The Mirror Test, about America at war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And after you got home, there are so many things in this book that we could talk about for hours, I think, when you talk about the politics of both wars. You supported President Obama, but then when he did the surge, you didn't necessarily support that because it was just, you know, we're stuck there still.
Yeah, I wanted this to be anything but a drive-by book. The more entertaining book, I could have, you know, written pages and pages about examples that may have gotten a laugh or you know, a cutting comment. But I really wanted this book to be even-handed. I wanted to be, by the end of it, an honest guide that a reader could say he had his views. You know, he's a mm-hmm. person like all of us. I vote every 4 years for commander in chief. But when I saw administrations making good or bad decisions, I wanted them to be captured in a genuine way. And so when President Obama escalated while we were there, I mean, those were our Marines. Mm-hmm. It's not like I was writing from a university or I was writing from another part of Afghanistan. I mean, Cal Worth's battalion landed in southern Afghanistan in Helmand when President Obama decided to surge because of, quote, well, the surge worked in Iraq. Well, I had lived both surges. So as I wrote this book, I wanted to kind of unwrap some of the layers that maybe are misunderstood or the mythology that's tied to the ground up level of these wars. And then I had insights, like you say, to some of the higher level decision making. And it was a tricky book to write, and I think that's also probably why it ended up being a very long book, is that there was a lot of ground to cover.
Well, it's a good read, but it's not a hard read. I mean, it's a hard emotional to read, but it's not a hard read because it just everything in it seems to make sense. Because you know, most of us don't know who really makes these decisions, especially in the military. You know, the guy that's the private on the ground or the E4 or Spec 4, whatever it is. You know, he's told to just go take that mountain, and okay. Why? We never ask the why part of it. And I think what's interesting in reading your book is that we can see the process, some of the process that you have to go through before that decision is made to take that mountain.
Right. And I've heard from some corporals who are now a bit grayer and 10 or 12 years older and maybe 40 pounds heavier, and they email me from across the country and say thank you for showing us what was going on inside Camp Fallujah at the time that Fallujah was being cleared, or thank you for at least trying to inform sort of what the Helmand strategy was when Marja became the main focus with an anti-poppy plan. So the book, the book does a lot, and it's moving at a pretty quick pace, but I decided the value I had was the length of time I'd been in these wars, and that I had been in some pretty rough spots where all of these counterinsurgency challenges sort of were being tested. And whether we succeeded or failed, it is a pretty wide lens of these wars. And I find the veterans get that to look at the politics of an election and then to look at the tactics of coordination with the British and Helmand is probably one of the advantages my book hopefully gives the reader by the end of it, that you get a pretty wide sense of these wars. It's not a one-man, one-city exploration. It's 7 years and two wars.
And then when you decided to get out of the State Department, why did you do that?
That's a very good question. I missed that role. I tell students, and I've been invited to colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. I was in Oregon and fairly recently, and I said, there's no greater honor or challenge than representing the United States, particularly in a time of war. And so I encourage the next generation, whether they want to join the military, my dad and uncles were all Army, a lot of my buddies are Marines, or the State Department, the Foreign Service, the USAID, that there is an incredibly rewarding aspect of waking up every day representing what I still consider to be the greatest country in the world. Mm-hmm. And there's the weird sub-debate going on about that. But I end my book by describing the U.S. as a great nation. It was before President Trump made that sort of a line of his own. I had written this book years before, really. So I left because I was burned out. I left because I was disaffected with just the human cost of war. Because in addition to our troops, I still get the emails and the phone calls from Iraqis and Afghans who are living the wars even in a more intense way because their home front remains a war front.
Right.
And while we could redeploy, they never can. So I needed a break from that. And then finally, I wanted to write a book. I couldn't have written the type of book by doing a State Department job. And I think my conscience wouldn't allow me to try and do it that way.
Well, since that time period, though, you have attempted to visit many of the gravestones and many of the families of those Marines who were killed in that helicopter crash. Is that correct?
I have, and I find I can't do more than one or two a year. I'd like to do homework about who these Americans were who served our nation, where they went to high school, kind of what their own unique story was. And the reason why, and I'm grateful for Knopf and my publisher who allowed me the extra pages, is I want to show that when that little scroll on the bottom of the TV says, another soldier or Marine or airman or Navy corpsman was killed, it's usually, name, age, and maybe hometown. But at least in three cases, Texas, and Wyoming and Iowa, I try and resurrect, maybe that's an overstated word, but I try and bring them a bit back to life by describing, you know, who they were, because that's really the story of warfare, I think, over time, is that it's not about kings and generals and presidents and prime ministers. It's truly about, you know, the people who live the wars on a day-to-day basis and don't get a vote in how they start or how they end.
Right. Could you tell us a little bit about a couple of those grave sites that you visited?
Yeah, I'll focus on maybe the one in Iowa, because it was very powerful. I went at a time when it was springtime and very beautiful, very much on Iraq. And as I drove into Cherokee, Iowa, I just was taking in what this town was like. And by the time I had done my jog around the town and went to the local high school, I realized, wait a minute, he's buried a little bit outside of town. And when I got there, the most powerful part is that I hadn't realized that this Marine had been killed literally the day before his birthday. And that was pretty hard to take. And then you look at the gravesite and you think, oh my gosh, you know, his father is buried literally, you know, right next to him. And so Nathan Schubert is his name, and that kind of, again, I wanted to add some pages in my book to say, here's one kid from, you know, the cornfields of Iowa. He died in a helicopter crash in a very remote part of Anbar. I also start the book in Wyoming. I mean, I'm from the West, and I have a lot of pride in that, and I wanted to kind of talk about a former drill instructor who was also on that helicopter. And at the very end of the book, gratefully to my editor's credit, he let me just put the words of the family and friends about each of these KIA, and I think that's probably the most powerful writing in the whole book, and it's not my own.
I think it is extremely powerful, and it just I'm a big, I don't want to say fan, supporter, I guess you can say, of memorials. And one of the reasons is, and I can't remember if I read it in your book or one of the articles while researching for you to be on the program today, where somebody said, you know, the memorials just allow people to remember, you know, who died in many cases. And if there wasn't a memorial, then that person would be forgotten forever.
Yeah, and the most powerful memorial, you know, is the home, literally the hometown of a city where the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is from in South Boston, General Dunford, and he features in the book because he was a one-star when this election support decision was being made, says, you know, if you forget my death, then I will have died in vain.
Right.
And I still believe that's the cleanest, most powerful set of words about whether people were for the Iraq War, against the Iraq War, believe we should be in Afghanistan or get the hell out of Afghanistan, that these memorials are a chance to remember. And to the credit of the current commandant, Marine Corps General Neller, he's pretty much set up a website, and he's, in effect, ordered Marines, you know, to get together. And I think that when we gathered in Leadville, Colorado one summer, we all, the Marines especially, wanted, you know, 2 or 3 days, but that was enough to sort of, what you're doing with your own radio program, tell the stories, retell the stories, and make sure that there's those connections that veterans need when they're out of uniform. And like you say, until they're, you know, at the local VA hospital, you know, in Ann Arbor or in Denver or wherever they may be.
I think one of the things that veterans like to do is when they do tell their stories to each other is that they just want to validate that it's true.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, when you're 60, 70 years old and you're talking about something happened when you were 18 or 19, it's you're hoping you're not getting all foggy, and you just and when you're with your buddies and they say, "Hey, remember when you did? You know, you took that hill almost by yourself."
Well, I know that, you know, I'm only, I don't know, 7 years out of some of these experiences, and I still have to triple and double check, you know, what I wrote in my little notebook or what was told to a friend at the same time while we were over there. But I think that's what, you know, the reunions do, and I think that the writing that's coming out of these wars is exciting because I think it takes some time to filter some of the experiences, and whether people write great novels or poetry or just pull out their journal and take some excerpts from there. I'm a believer that, you know, in the good old Ken Burns fashion, I love documentaries, and there's a big new one coming out on Vietnam, I understand, pretty soon.
Right.
I was always blown away back in high school when he did the Civil War series. And so the Soldier's War Journal at the end of my book, I would also point readers to, which, again, to the credit of my publisher, they gave me more pages and never said, well, that's going to cost us 30 more cents per book. And what I love about that is that there's a soldier named Balin Orr who went to Sauter City, and he sent me kind of unexpectedly just excerpts from his journal. And it reminds me that, again, some of the most powerful writing to come out of any war is just the soldier, the Marine, getting in a scrap of paper every night and saying, you know, here's what happened. Well, Now they're on computers, so it's maybe easier to get. And I hope that one day, you know, the great documentary will be done of, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, and you can have the voice of the corporal next to the voice of a General Nicholson or a General Dunford next to the voice.
I think it's always so important. I agree. I love those documentaries too, especially when we hear the voices or the stories of the people that are on the lower levels who, you know, have to, you know, execute the orders and so forth.
If your listeners have never watched the British television's The World at War from 1973, it's by far, I mean, it's the iconic series. And there's one titled Occupation, which is the Dutch experience, and from the civilian point of view, and it is the most powerful documentary making I've ever seen. And so I actually reference that in my book, hoping that if it's just three readers that go online and watch it.
It does. I have watched many of those documentaries myself. We've got about 5 minutes to go, Cale. So you're not done yet. You've gotten yourself involved in another little project here that I want to kind of transition to, about war dogs. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got involved with that?
Yeah, General Nicholson and I were invited to a Semper Fi Fund fundraiser in Alexandria, Virginia, and a Marine walked up to me afterward. Of course, he was intimidated to go to the general directly right away and said, you know, I have a military working dog that I'm trying to get reunited with. It's been, I think at that point, 2 years or so, and his dog was named Freeze. And so I said, hey, I'm happy to help try and track down where your black lab Freeze is, because I got to know some of these dogs when I was over in Helmand too, and I like dogs. You know, I had some dogs while I was growing up. So that case was relatively easy. General Nicholson and I and a lot of well-meaning other people managed to track Freeze down, and we were able to reunite him pretty quickly. The more challenging dog reunion happened when I received an email from a mother about her Marine son, Matt, and his dog, Rocky. And there's a chapter in my book about that because, amid some of the harder chapters, this, I think, was a story of a bond that anyone who's had a pet, particularly a dog, can relate to, and especially, you know, in a place where these dogs are trained to sniff out IEDs. And so Matt and Rocky were eventually reunited, but only after we were able to track him down as one of the bird dogs for the president's helicopter fleet, Marine One. So that took a bit more fancy footwork and keyboard work on my part. But to the credit of the Marine Corps, the colonel in charge of Marine One, and with some generals obviously in oversight and overwatch position, realized that this dog really should be back with the Marine who had fought alongside him in Helmand versus, you know, being a pointer dog toward, I don't know what kind of birds fly around the swamps of Virginia. So we got them reunited, and it's I think something that's still going on with many Marines and their dogs, and you're starting to get some good books written about the dogs in these wars.
Yeah, we've got there's a Michigan War Dog Memorial here just north of Ann Arbor, and one of the reasons it kind of fell into disrepair, and when somebody found it, you know, it grow overgrown in the woods and so forth. And one of the reasons that they cleaned it all up and everything was that there was an Iraq veteran, I think it was, who was finally able to get his dog, and I think he was in the Army, and was finally able to get his dog, and unfortunately the dog died of cancer, and they wouldn't let the dog be buried in a national cemetery at the time. And so these people at the Michigan War Dog Memorial buried the dog with full military honors and just got everybody all excited. And I think that, that what has happened is that the military has been more, much more cooperative with getting these war dogs reunited with their owners.
Yeah, that's a huge part of the after war that we shouldn't forget, and I'm glad to hear that, because it's also a way to bring, I think, the general population closer to these wars, because people can relate to dogs in a way that maybe when they look at the globe can't.
That's true. Dog stories are our most popular programs.
Well, I have a good dog chapter titled Semper Fido and the Sierras. So Semper Fido was one of the more fun chapters to write.
We'll have to do that. You're also involved with it. Is it the Spirit of America?
Yeah, thank you for asking. It's a great private nonprofit group. We're based in L.A. now. A lot of them are back and working out of D.C. A lot of veterans who lived these wars up close wanted to stay involved. And so Spirit of America was founded by a gentleman named Jim Hake, who's an incredible entrepreneur who had done early work in the Bay Area on the technology side, and then decided on 9/11, hey, I need to do something. And I like that story of Spirit of America because it shows what the private, non-governmental, innovative side of America can do, and then Americans who hear about it and decide, "Hey, I want to help," and they work very closely with our military, and they are able, I think, to, I like to use the word inoculate, try and inoculate areas so that they don't become the terrorist safe havens, or they don't become the places where SEAL and Delta Force teams need to go in, or drones need to fly above, or hell, State Department officials go in and work the local politics. So it's a chapter that I think also shows that after 9/11, some citizens did some good and innovative things. And I wanted the reader to maybe think, well, hey, I don't need to have my son or daughter join the Marine Corps to help. Maybe I can go online and check out Spirit of America.
Yeah. We are going to get more people to do that, and maybe I can utilize you to put me in touch with some of the people there and get them on.
I'd love to have you invite Spirit of America, Jim Hake, and his team on. They would be a great guest.
Okay. Well, we've come up to the end of another hour, and Cale, I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio. This book is something that all of you need to read out there. I think it's so important. It's called The Mirror Test, and the mirror test in this case is that we have to look at how we're getting involved in these wars around the world. And so thank you so much for being on the program, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, Dale and Nina. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. All right. So another one's in the can, as they say, and I thank you all for listening to Veterans Radio. We will be back next week. We're going to be looking at World War II with the Bataan Death March. Until then, you are dismissed.